I am Plante on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Last night, for the four federal leaders whose parties are represented in the House of Commons met in a national broadcast for a debate. Its moderator, Steve Paikin, joins me now. This was his third time moderating, first doing so in 2006 and again in 2008. After each debate, he's graciously come on here to tell us about the debate, what it was like in the room, and more. Steve Paikin is the host of TVO's The Agenda. He's the author of four books, including The Dark Side, one of my favorite books ever. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Steve Paikin. Good morning, Mr. Paikin.
This is a post-debate tradition that I look forward to. Hi, Joseph. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
A-okay.
The butterflies all gone now?
Not quite.
No.
working on it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I read somewhere that you almost threw up yesterday.
No, I was being a little facetious to somebody, but you know, the tension is quite thick in the days leading up to the thing, and of course it requires a great deal of preparation, and then when the leaders come out at about, you know, 4 minutes to seven, that's a very long 4 minutes that we're all kind of standing around or sitting around, they at their podiums, me at my desk, and, you know, waiting for the clock to chime seven. So it's, it's tense.
Yeah. People liked the format last night, the one-on-ones, right?
Well, I must tell you, I got a ton of both emails and tweets from Twitter, and that was the one thing that I think everybody agreed on. Naturally, everybody sees the debate their own way and through their, you know, through their own opinionated prism, if I can put it that way. But the one thing that I had near unanimity on was that everybody liked the format, which was, of course, different from the previous time. This year, we had the 6-minute one-on-one to start each question and then broadened out to a four-person debate, and universal praise for the new format. I think virtually everybody I heard from liked it.
You've done two debates now with leaders at podiums and one at a desk. Is there one that you prefer?
Hard to say. You know, I'm obviously more familiar with everybody at a table because that's what I do every night on TVO on The Agenda.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a problem with the podiums last night. I remember in 2006... My desk and the podiums were farther away from each other, which made kind of trying to keep everybody under control, as it were, was more difficult. But this time, my desk was closer to their podiums, so that didn't seem to be a problem. And I know there was one moment kind of early on in the debate where everybody started speaking at once, and, you know, I kind of let it go for a couple of seconds, because hopefully the best way to do these things is to hope that they can work these problems out themselves. But they didn't, so I got in there and said, you know, we can't hear you if everybody talks at once. And I don't think that was a problem again for the rest of the night. So I can't really say I have a preference at this point.
Now, some days before we saw the matchups. It was, I guess, Harper and Duceppe first, the six sort of pairs come out first. Were the questions that they got last night on tape, were they tailored for each pairing, or was that just all random?
No, that was all random. I think the consortium got, I think, about 6,000 questions. They decided what the six would be, randomly put them in whatever order they went in, randomly assigned, you know, the pair-offs to the six questions. So it just worked out that way, you know. And in some ways it kind of worked very well. You had Michael Ignatieff and Stephen Harper on governance, which was a key issue that the two of them have cared about. And, you know, in other parts of the debate, it didn't work as well. I think you had one where you had Michael Ignatieff and Gilles Duceppe one-on-one on crime and justice issues, about which they don't really disagree very much. So, you know, when it's luck of the draw, it's hit and miss. And no exception last night. Some of it went really, really well, and some of it was, you know, a little less than satisfying.
So when you say that they got about 6,000 questions, there were six questions on the debate. Was that, how were the questions determined? Was it because you got 1,000 questions on each of the six things that you got last night?
Very much like that. You might have got 500 questions on healthcare, and a lot of them are the same. Remember, they're trying to make sure when they pick the questions that the country is geographically well represented, that both genders are well represented, you know, different people of different ethnic backgrounds might be represented. So it's a bit of a balancing act. So it's not only, you know, what question, but also you need to feel, if you're watching the debate, that your region of the country somehow got represented during the course of the debate as well. So A lot of things to balance there. Very difficult. And, you know, every time we do one of these debates, I mean, the reality is you've got last year it was, or last time I should say, it was 5 liters. This time it was 4 liters. You've only got 2 hours. You know, you've got to have a reasonable amount of time for them to discuss the issues. You can't put 20 questions in there and have them debate them all for 3 minutes. That doesn't make any sense. So, you know, it's a really tough balancing act, and it's never possible to get it perfect. But you do the best you can. And, you know, last night the 6 issues that we did pick, I thought, were top of mind and very relevant considering what we're considering during the course of this election campaign. But having said that, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was missed. And that's just inevitable when you try to bring everything down to 6 questions.
You mentioned that, the questioners, they didn't seem... I read in a blog this morning, and they complained that they weren't ethnically diverse, that they were all, I guess, white.
Is that, the questioners.
Yeah, the questioners on film, on tape. How long ago did you know you were going to do this debate?
Oh, gosh. I can't even remember now. Well, when was that? Was a week and a half, something like that?
Yeah.
2 weeks, something like that. I forget now.
Yeah. The consortium that organizes these debates, they haven't gotten much good press in the last few weeks.
They're in a very unenviable position. That's true.
Yeah, and you made it clear on your blog, on the Agenda's website, and in that op-ed that you wrote for the Citizen, the Ottawa Citizen, that you're not a member of the consortium, that you're just hired to do this job. Is it a dark an organization as say Elizabeth May portrays it to be?
Is it dark? That's I think everybody knows what it is. It's made up of the major broadcasters of the country that are going to carry the debate, that pay for the debate to take place. Obviously, there are a ton of factors that they have to take into account. They all have different objectives here. You know, on the one hand, the CBC doesn't want to have the debate on a night when they want to show the Stanley Cup playoffs, because that will be a massive revenue loss for them. Private consortium members, private television members of the consortium, don't want to have the debate on a night where they may have some boffo, you know, huge ratings success program on that they would have to preempt in order to show the debate. I've heard a lot of good arguments. Robin Sears, the former New Democrat advisor, says that we are now at a point where really the responsibility for putting this thing together ought to be taken away from the consortium and some kind of independent commission created. And, you know, they'll make the decision, and if you want your license renewed, if you're a broadcaster and you want your license renewed, you have to put it on when this new independent consortium says so, and if you don't, well, then we'll rip your license away. I don't know, maybe that's the way to go. I don't know. There's no perfect system, and I know that, you know, like we did a program on this ourselves, Joseph, after Queen's University put out a study on this. And, you know, we considered a lot of different options, and I know Trina McQueen, who moderated one of the debates in 2006, said that it should be so much broader, that not just one leader's debate, you might want to have many. You might want to, for example, have Bravo Television host a debate with the culture minister and the culture critics on issues related to heritage and culture. You might want to have the Discovery Channel do something on science or the environment. You might want to have TVO do one, especially on education. Who knows? I mean, this was her idea. And, they're all good ideas. They're all good ideas. It's a question of how much participation the parties want and how much airtime the broadcasters are prepared to put towards it.
The decision to not allow the Green Party, after you came on, was there... after you signed on, I should say, to be the moderator, was there talk within the group if, in fact, it could happen? Say one of the holdouts acquiesced.
Well, you say holdouts, and you know,
I mean, that's what we've heard in the press, that there was a holdout.
Look, you may know more about this than I do. I really, you know, the fact is that the Green Party were not invited by the consortium to participate, and. You know, it strains credulity to think that the four other main parties that do have seats in the House of Commons were somehow going to refuse to participate in a leader's debate unless the Greens were allowed to participate. You know, that's not in their interest to do so if you look at the narrow partisan interest of the thing. And the broadcasters, for whatever reasons they said, and the one reason overwhelmingly they said is that the Greens don't have any seats in the House, made a decision not to include them. you know, this is one of those. I remember, as you know, I did a book on John Robarts, the former Ontario premier, once upon a time. John Robarts used to have an expression that, you know, by the time an issue got to his desk, there were so many good arguments on either side of it, you could basically flip a coin to make your decision about which way you wanted to go.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for the participation of the Greens. I mean, there are good reasons to include them. There are good reasons to exclude them. And, you know, the consortium, in its wisdom, made a decision about that. If we had, you know, an independent commission that had, concrete, firm criteria in place, you meet these criteria, you're allowed to participate, you don't meet these criteria, you can't participate, maybe it would be simpler. But then, I mean, Joe, what happens if you get into a situation where, let's say, you got to be at 5% in the public opinion polls to participate, and the Greens punch in at 4.9? I mean, are you going to keep them out because they failed to get one-tenth of a percentage point of popular vote? Well, technically, I guess you could. This is why there's, you know, I've talked to so many people about this, and I've had lots of emails, and there's lots of chatter on Facebook about it, and I've tried really hard to kind of engage people and hear what they have to say about this. And, the reality is there will never be a system that will satisfy everybody, or maybe not even, 90% of the people. It just may well be that this is one of these things that's just never going to be quite right. But in my experience, I thought the format last night got the closest to the best thing I've seen so far.
I thought so, too, yeah. And, I just had a thought maybe you should start a commission, Steve.
Thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to let somebody else take the heat for that.
Some of the rules that you were constrained by interest me. Say if someone outright lied, one of the leaders lied, or they said something like there was no Soviet domination in Eastern Europe, would you correct them? I mean, could you correct them?
You've referred specifically to a larger issue, which is basically when does the moderator intervene and how and why and how much. And as you could tell last night, we basically made a decision. When I say we, I mean me and Mark Bogutch, who's the producer of the debates, and Fred Parker, who's the director of the debates. We basically had a get-together ahead of time and kind of agreed on the notion that as long as they're not all screaming at each other at once, and as long as it is moving along and it appears to be a good, energetic, vigorous debate, then I should sort of sit back and not, be an air hog, as it were. And I'm very sensitive to that. People didn't tune in to hear me. They tune in to hear the leaders. And so as long as it was going along tickety-boo, I was content to let that happen. If one leader tells what you describe as just an outright lie, I think we can rely on the judgment of the other leaders there to say, well, wait a sec, that's not true at all. And then they will discuss amongst themselves the accuracy of the statement, and the Canadian people can judge who's right and who's wrong. As you know from last night, I made basically one intervention and one intervention only because it seemed to me that it was going along smoothly. They were policing each other rather well. It was at the very last segment on the issue of health care when they were all going around, but it seemed to me that none of them, I think about 6 minutes into the four-on-one, none of them were really discussing the elephant in the room, which is you're all making, hugely expensive health care promises while trying to keep taxes low, while trying to balance extremely high deficits with growth rates that are around 2%. Do any of you really have, realistic platforms on this? And that was the one area where I felt I was on okay ground to intervene, and so I did. But otherwise, I was content to sort of let them carry it.
Yeah. Now, they had cards on the podium.
They did.
I sort of saw Mr. Layton. He had notes written on them already. Were they allowed
to
do
that?
Oh, they all did.
Yeah, the idea was, I think the rules were no blank notepads in which you take notes, but you can go in with, I guess what they call, recipe cards or cheat notes or whatever you want to call them. And so remember, they knew the general topic areas going into the debate, so they could go in there with some recipe cards with some talking points on them. But they didn't know what the specific questions were. You saw in the very first answer, and this was another question about, do I intervene or don't I intervene? the question was about corporate tax cuts, and Mr. Harper gave his answer, and then Monsieur Duceppe immediately talked about the leaked Auditor General's report, which frankly had nothing to do with corporate tax cuts. And now, if that was an episode of The Agenda, I would have intervened right away and said, you know, that's all very interesting, but that's not what the subject is about that we're talking about. But, you know, given that it's kind of their debate, and I didn't hear anything in my ear, namely a producer saying, you know what, this is off topic, rein this in, we kind of allowed them to police each other on this. And you know what, that was such a huge topic, it broke, you know, so late in the game, that we knew that at some point they were all going to want to get into it, so they got into it when they got into it, and that's the way it was.
Well, one of the things I remember you tweeting about when this government fell that day and the confidence vote in Ottawa, you talked about the atmosphere and problem, and a lot of people did, the sort of collegiality amongst the MPs and the sort. What was the mood like in the room last night?
Well, remember, there's no one room. They're all in separate rooms, and then they come out to the set with about 4 minutes to go, which doesn't really allow a lot of time for any camaraderie. They go through, I guess they have a photo op at about 6:30, 6:35, something like that, where all of them come out at once, and they do this kind of, you know, handshake, and they all put their hands in the middle and that kind of thing. And that did actually seem fairly collegial. I mean, they're considering what was at stake and how tense it could have been, and awkward. You know, it is kind of awkward. They don't, let's face it, they don't like each other, and yet they have to sit there and kind of smile and all put their hands in together, like, here we go, one for all and all for one. But that seemed fine. And at the end of it, it seemed to me that they all, you know, shook hands in a gentlemanly fashion, and then off they went.
Yeah, they all did scrums after. Were you scrummed after?
I wasn't, but I attended their scrums. Yeah, I watched all of their scrums.
They were all asked who won the debate, and they were reticent to say who.
That's understandable.
Yeah, did you get a sense of anyone winning the debate sitting in the room with them?
You know, you're going to think I'm dodging you here, Joseph, but the fact is, no, I really didn't. You got to remember, this is a television experience, and you know. The five people who didn't experience it as a television experience were the four leaders and me. We didn't see it on TV. We were kind of there on the set. And I guess I've learned now, this is the third federal and I've done one provincial, Ontario, leaders debate as well. And the one thing I've learned is that the experience of being there on the set can be completely different from the experience of somebody watching it on television. Remember, I'm not paying attention to, you know, whether they're looking in cameras or not, or what camera angles are picking up, or what reaction shots are being picked up by the director. So I'm experiencing it completely differently. And beyond that, I've got, you know, a timekeeper talking to me in my ear. I've got producer reminding me, you know, who's up on time, who's down on time. Because there was a moment midway through the debate where Jack Layton had, for some reason, you know, just fallen behind in time. And Mark Bulgach prompted me in my ear to say, you know, Mr. Layton's a little low right now. You've got to make sure you get him more time in this next segment. So that's, you know, when you're trying to sort of juggle all that and then remember what's the next question we're going to and who are the two they're going to face off in this next segment, I don't experience it at all in the way that a television viewer would, because there's just, frankly, there's too much going on.
There was an audience in the room, was there?
There was an audience, and, you know, we've never had that before, but the audience was very much off to the side, and it was only invited guests, you know, family, friends, party officials, that kind of thing. So a fairly small audience, I would guess not more than 100. And Mark Bulgach did come out ahead of time and warn them, because we figured this out during the walkthroughs in the afternoon, the acoustics of the room were such that if anybody made any noise in the audience area, you could really hear it on the set very, very loudly. So he warned them ahead of time, you know, no heckling, no talking, turn your phones off. You know, if somebody cracks a joke, obviously you can smile or chuckle if it's worth it. We're not trying to make you into robots, but you know, no hissing, no booing, no clapping. Let's not take time away from the leaders. And as far as I could tell, everybody followed those rules very well. I didn't hear any distractions from the audience at all.
I did hear them react when Mr. Layton used the word bling and hashtag fail.
Yes, and the joke about, you know, all the criminals in the Senate.
I did hear
them chuckle about that. That is true. Now that you mention it, yes, I do remember hearing a little chuckling out of the corner of my ear on that one.
Yeah. On the agenda a week or so ago, you interviewed Brian Mulroney.
Yes.
I had a question about that. There were a couple of moments that were fascinating to watch. The first was when you brought up Lucien Bouchard. The second, of course, when you brought up Karl-Heinz Schreiber. He seemed uncomfortable, and then he sort of smiled and said what he had to say about Schreiber and that whole business, and he sort of looked off to his left, which would be your right. Well, who was he looking at or smiling at?
I don't know, because I don't think there was any, but there were, you know, obviously you would expect there to be handlers, quote-unquote, in the room at that time.
Yeah.
But there weren't.
Really?
It was Mr. Mulrooney, it was me, it was our two cameramen, it was our producer, Daniel Kitts, you know, who would, you know, part of his job was to keep me on time. We had a half an hour, and, you know, he had to give me time counts during it. But Mr. Mulrooney's two, I'm trying to remember now, he had two or three associates who may have come with him, but they would have been, I don't even think they were in the room, if memory serves. I think they were, and if, yeah, you know, I'm having a bit of a fuzzy memory on this here, but I don't think they were in the room, so I don't know who he was looking off at. And you know what? I'm not even sure. I share your view that he reacted kind of nervously when I raised this. I'm sure he had to expect that I was going to raise Karl-Heinz Schreiber, and you know, I thought his answer. You know, I'm not surprised at his answer. He basically said, "I'm not going there," but then he sort of did go there a little bit, and I thought gave a pretty honest answer, which was, you know, tell me anybody who's lived 70 years on this planet who's never made a mistake, and you know. He's one of them.
Yeah, he sort of moved in the chair, sort of made him look uncomfortable. I don't think he was nervous, yeah.
Okay.
The other thing I've always wanted to ask you, and I'll end on this, Steve, how do you, did you grow up with Martin Short?
Boy, that one's really out of left field, isn't it? Well, here's the background on that. Martin Short's dad and my grandfather were in the steel business together in Hamilton. We're both Hamiltonians, and so the Short family and the Pakin family have been friends for, you know, I guess, 70 years, something like that. I mean, it's a long time.
Yeah.
And my dad and my parents and Martin are great, wonderful friends today, as, you know, I believe I am too. And he's had an awful year. His wife passed away this past year, and he was up actually... well, he came up to Canada for a little while. He's got a cottage still in Canada, and he's coming up again this summer, and I expect to see him then. And we talked on the phone, I guess, a few weeks ago as well. And my heart just goes out to him. Martin has had an extraordinary life insofar as he lost both his parents while he was a teenager. He had a brother who predeceased him, an older brother who predeceased him when he was a kid. You know, his wife died in her 50s. And on the other hand, he has lived this, you know, spectacularly successful life where he is brilliant at what he does, has three wonderful children. He has, you know, for a guy who's been in show business as long as he had one of those just classically successful, wonderful showbiz marriages that you just can't imagine you're able to have with all of the pressures of a Hollywood life and temptations and so on, but take it from me, they had the real deal. I mean, anybody who could have had that kind of marriage would want that kind of marriage. Martin and Nancy were just so wonderful together, and you know, I guess he's 10 years older than me, so he just turned 61. I'm going to turn 51 in a couple of months, and you know, like, I just don't know how he does it. He still performs. He still, he goes on talk shows. He's still funny, and he's just, I mean, I'm in tears when I think about what the guy's been through and how he manages to just get up in the morning. He's a hero of mine. He just does it.
He's such a brilliant comic, and
totally.
And I brought that up because I remember an interview you did with him a couple of years ago, and it made me wonder how well you knew one another.
Well, I've known him since I was a little kid, I have such admiration for the guy because, talk about the highest highs and the lowest lows that he's experienced in life, and somehow he has, and you know, it comes through every time we are in each other's company or we talk. He's just got such wonderful perspective on life. He gets it. And you know, it's funny, Joseph, I'm sitting here in my office as I talk to you, and on my wall in front of me, among all the pictures I have and the political buttons and, you know, all of this, I have here a chart, which I always keep in front of me, and I look at almost every day, and it's called Martin Short's Secrets to a Good Life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's basically nine things. How am I? How are my wife and kids? How's my extended family? How are my friends? Am I financially okay? How's my career? How's my creativity? How's my discipline? How's my lifestyle? And this man, despite the high highs and the low lows he's had in his life, has somehow been able to look at those nine secrets to a good life and keep them, you know, close to his heart. And I think it's brilliant advice for, you know, not getting too up when things go well and not getting too down when things go badly and just keeping it all in perspective. He's a great, I'm actually thrilled that you asked me about him because he's just one of the truly great, great people I've had a chance to know and learn from, I hope people who listen to this just appreciate what a magnificent guy he really is.
Yeah, he just seems like it, and you know, and I'm kind of glad that I know that now about him. I mean, I just know him from when he goes on Letterman, and he's hilarious on Letterman.
He is, isn't he?
It sounds as though I'm sucking up Steve, but I don't care. You did such a great job last night, and I remain a big fan.
You're very kind, and once again, thank you for calling, and I actually do look forward to, you won't believe this, but actually, as soon as the debate was over last night, I thought to myself, I wonder what Joe's going to ask me tomorrow, because this is a bit of a tradition for us, and it's a bit of a debrief, you know, it's a chance for me to kind of debrief on how things went, and even though you get a lot of tweets and a lot of emails, I can't really get enough feedback on how things went, the format, how the leaders did, who won. You know, whether I cocked it up, I do want to know all this, and you're a very sensible sounding board for all this stuff, so I appreciate our conversations as well.
Thank you very much, Steve.
All the best, Joe.
The Agenda airs nightly on TVO. You can watch it on TVO's website, tvo.org, or on TVO's YouTube channel, which I do regularly. Steve Pickett on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.